Good morning. Welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Chewett and your co-host today is Michael Cigani. Michael, good morning to you.
Morning, Hugh.
The ever unpopular MPF is celebrating its 15th birthday this month and we're joining the party. Changes which have been billed as the most significant happen since the fund was launched in 2000 are imminent. First, it's likely there will be a core fund established, a default fund with a management fee of just 0.75%, about half the current average fee. That might be coming next year. And there's also fierce discussion at the moment about scrapping the offset mechanism under which employers can reclaim their contribution to employees' schemes to offset severance or long-term payments. Employers say change would push up labour costs and senior staff would be the first to go in that situation. So how do you feel about the MPF? Are you happy? What do you make of those proposed changes? If there's a universal pension scheme, for example, do you think we will still need an MPF? Email us with your thoughts, questions and comments. Backchat at rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, which is Backchat and RTHK Radio 3. Comment there or call. 233 88266. Later in the programme we'll be talking about express rail expenditure and hearing more from Operation Santa Claus. Joining us in Central Zoo, we have David Webb, shareholder activist, founder of website.com, Philip Cho, who's director of investment services at Towers Watson, and Lorchi Kwong, associate professor in the Department of Social Work and Social Administration at the University of Hong Kong, chairman of the Community Care Fund Task Force under the Commission on Poverty. Good morning to you all, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning. Morning.
Philip Cho, maybe we'll start with you. I said it's an ever unpopular MPF. I've never really met anyone who's very happy, to be honest, you know, with the MPF who doesn't work for the MPF.
Well, the fund managers are happy.
maybe the fund managers. Maybe I don't talk to enough fund managers like yourself. What do you think we should be celebrating 15 years of the MPF? Do you think it's working?
Well, whether it is a celebration, I think it depends on who you talk to. But I think we all admit that MPF is not perfect. There's still areas for improvement in many areas. And I think what we try to think about is it's only 15 years for a retirement system compared to like global, like much bigger pension system. This is still a baby. Singapore is like more than 50 years. US, UK, they're all long history. Australia is more than 25 years. So, I mean, this is something that I think we need to make sure that I think the MPFA, the industry players, like everybody, have an open mind and positive attitude, slightly positive attitude. I know it's difficult to say it's entirely positive attitude, to accept the fact that it is a baby. I mean, there are still many improvements need to be sorted out, like the core fund, efficiency, the offsetting, and all the other stuff. So I wouldn't call it a celebration, but I think at least it's something that we should be proud of, that the MPF system is now already up to 560 billion asset in total over the 15 years. And we project that the asset that by year 2020, the total asset would be exceeding 1 trillion Hong Kong dollars, which means that average people would have like $500,000 Hong Kong on their balances.
Yeah, but you know, you said people should be patient, should be tolerant, should wait. How can they, for these reasons? Number one, the cost, the managing costs are very high. Number two, when they retire, the MPF is not going to give them the kind of money that they need to retire. Mm. Number three, they feel that a lot of that money is going to the pockets of the people handling the money rather than going into their own pockets when they retire. So whether it's a baby or not, it's not working out for them. Why should they be happy?
Well, first of all, I think that the MPF, the main purpose of that is not meant to be supporting like people's entire retirement expense when they retire at
age
65.
Yeah, but you still expect a certain sum of money to come back.
Yes.
Not so little that it becomes meaningless.
Yes. Well, according to the World Bank, you know that, like, we all know that there are five pillars, right? MPF is one of the pillars that to support everybody's retirement life. So, I mean, no one ever said that this is the only thing, and it shouldn't be. And then we know that, like, you know, the support, like, the contribution, if you only rely on one single source to support your retirement, need to be at least 20% of the salary for 40 years, so to speak. So, I mean, that's one thing. Now, the other thing is that we see that the fees are coming down slowly. I mean, we probably expect a little bit more faster. With the core fund like happening next year, hopefully that would actually create a lot more competition and get the providers to look hard how they can actually improve the internal efficiency and try to bring the cost down and give the scale, basically.
Michael, to be fair, if
if you think in terms of the contribution rate that we are having right now, which is just 5%, and together with there's a ceiling on a certain level, well, if you just look at it on an actuary basis, this is basically not sufficient for anybody. Well, that is by it is a defect by design. Mm-hmm. If you look around the world, anything less than like 12-15% is not considered to be adequate. And in fact, we are actually less than 10% because of the ceiling and because there are people who don't even have to contribute. So by design, it is a very defective system.
I take your point. It is 5%. Therefore, by design, there's a problem there. Other countries should talk about 10 or 12% or whatever it is. But then if you change it so that you can put in 10 or 12, I contribute to American Social Security. The handling costs are a lot lower than here. Investment, I have Roth IRA in the
US. That is a scale issue, right?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
that.
But the point I'm making is if you allow people to increase their contribution, but bring down the fund manager cost, people may be able to do it, or they might want to do it.
There's both chicken and egg thing. Well, if you can increase the contribution, you increase the scale, the management fees can go down. And furthermore, you know, the whole issue about full portability is one of the major barrier to cut down costs because we have accounts which is so tiny, a few hundred dollars, and they have to manage them. And one person may have 30 different accounts spreading around different fund managers. And you know that management cost is pretty expensive. Well, if you have a much bigger scale and if you have full portability where people can consolidate their tiny accounts spreading across different operators, then the management fees naturally will go down. Well, definitely we need the MPFA to do a little bit more to ensure that the management fees can go down.
Did you mention the ceiling? Was there a ceiling? I didn't know there was a ceiling for MPF contributions.
Yes. Well, I'll leave it to Philip.
Yes. The ceiling is, I think it started like $20,000 Hong Kong per month on the salary. It's now up to
30,000. Yes. So, I mean, you wouldn't be aware of the ceiling yet, Hugh, but one day you'll get there. So, you know, that's a maximum contribution of $3,000 a month in total from both sides. So that's the ceiling.
And well, David Webb, you know,
that's what I mean. Sorry, I mean, yeah. You can put more money into your MPF.
That is voluntary.
Oh, yeah, you can. That's what I'm talking about, yes.
I don't know why you're talking about allowing people to do it. They already can.
Yeah, exactly.
They choose not to because it's a very expensive way of saving money.
That's exactly what I said.
You said we should be proud, you know, Philip.
No, you should be ashamed.
You said we should be proud of the amount of money that's in there. But in fact, it's the minimum that people can put in there.
Well, I mean, if you look at the statistics, every year members can contribute to the system on a voluntary basis. And there's a special voluntary contribution arrangement, which last year there were $5 billion Hong Kong dollars put in the system.
Oh, okay.
Now, these are the arrangements that like members just take the initiative on their own and make the contribution to the system.
Out of a total contribution of how much?
It's around like $45 billion.
So it's still something. So only about 10% additional.
Yeah, well, we're better than nothing.
But contributions were made.
I think.
And people don't realize that there are better ways to save money than putting it into the MPF.
Yeah, but David Webb, that shows some success, doesn't it? I didn't realize it was as much as that.
It shows some minor irrationality on the part of some participants, but you know, this has gone on long enough. It's time to scrap the MPF. It's been 15 years of experimentation. Nobody likes it. If you had an opinion poll tomorrow or a referendum on it, you would definitely see the law repealed. MPF stands for mandatory payment to fund managers. That's what it is. It's a mandatory fund management scheme.
So they were kind of a central provident fund or something else.
No, I'm in favor of people having the freedom to decide how to save their money. The scheme came with all the wrong intentions to start with because it basically said that we're going to force people to save when they should be free to choose to save, and many of them already do. They buy property, they buy stocks, they buy gold. They save up and put down the deposit on an apartment, which provides security for their old age if they manage to complete paying off the mortgage. And in many cases, it's the same bank that's managing their MPF money that's lending them money to buy a flat. So you've got the bank making profits on both sides of that equation. And it takes longer for an employee on a given amount of income to buy a flat if they have to divert some of their income into the MPF
scheme. Yeah, but, you know, as Dr. Logic Kwong said, you know, middle class people can afford to buy homes, but the poorer people cannot. So this is one way.
It's the taxpayer.
And the poorer people below a threshold, which is currently 7,100, I think, they don't have to make contributions anyway. The amount that they will get when they retire won't be very much, and they'll still fall back onto the social safety net of whatever CSSA payments that we have at the time. And there's certainly scope to raise the level of the social safety net for people in need, but there's no reason to continue with this misconceived plan, which basically reduces their disposable income during their working lifetimes.
So does any pension or any saving.
Yes, it does, and that's why these things should be voluntary.
Yeah, but you know, you said that if there was a referendum tomorrow, people would vote out the MPF.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, if there was a referendum in the USA tomorrow, people would not vote out Social Security. So where's the difference?
Well, the difference is very different set of benefits. In Social Security, you have things like Medicaid to pay all your health care bills after 65 are paid for by the government.
Medicaid is for the poorer people.
Medicare, sorry. Right. Well, you know the program I'm talking about.
There
are a very different set of benefits.
But we already have...
And Social Security in America is not a funded scheme anyway. It's a pay-as-you-go scheme.
But what David is speaking of, well, is probably representing the upper middle class. If you talk about a medium income person with earning $15,000 a month, okay, raising a family of three, imagine how much he can save to buy a house. Well, the money he saved will likely be put in the deposit in the bank and losing on average like 2-3% in terms of inflation every year. So that is what we're talking about mid-income person, $15,000 a month raising a family of three. Can you ask that guy to voluntarily save? Well, yes, I agree that the MPF by design has a lot of defect. And it doesn't really help those who are low income because of the design. And so that's why there is a lot of revamping that we have to do on the MPF thing.
People have a long history of saving when they can in Hong Kong. They don't get penalized like other governments do by charging them capital gains taxes and dividends taxes and taxes on the interest income.
You're still talking about other countries, upper middle class.
But what happened to people who are not upper middle class?
Those who can't save won't save anyway through the MPF. Only the employers will pay into their schemes and reduce their take-home income during that process.
Those who are earning below $7,100 that they do not have to contribute. I'm talking about just the mid-income person, $15,000 a month. Can you tell me what kind of saving instrument that's better than inflation in Hong Kong for this group of people?
Yes,
I can tell you
better?
Right away. I can tell you right away. If they were free to put the money into the investments of their own choice, they could choose the tracker fund, for example, which charges 0.1% per annum.
I'm very surprised that
compared to 1.6%. The MPF scheme, even now after 15 years of reductions in gradual competition, is still charging 1.6% per year, which is 16 times what it would cost to save money through buying the tracker fund and just holding that. And so, you know, and you could buy.
What's the entry for the Charters Fund, please?
What's the
entry? How much they have to pay for
one share costs less than $100. I don't know exactly, but it's certainly giving people the choices and allowing direct investments.
And do you happen to know, David, David Webb, how that's performed? If you'd put the money in the tracker fund,
I don't have the figures to hand, but basically it's a benchmark for the whole index. It tracks the Hang Seng index. So
yeah, I know.
So if you put some, I'm not saying you should put all of your money into equities. There are other things you can do with it, such as paying off your mortgage if you have one, paying off your credit cards if you have them, and so on. But there are, it's one of the most efficient equity savings vehicles, and not just that one, but there are plenty of ETFs to choose from now as well.
Look at the number. $15,000 a month, contribution to MPF, $75 a month. That is what we're talking about, the median earning.
No, it's 750. It's 5% each, and it's $1,500 in total. I don't know why you get $75. You have $1,500 a month. Every 6 months, you could take $9,000 and buy some units in the tracker fund or in a property REIT like Mink REIT or
$700 buy a tracker fund?
Yeah, but
sure.
You've got seven shares. Yes.
Obviously, you have no experience of the stock market.
Can you buy in the market?
Professor Law, but you should...
What is the lot number, not lock size for a tracker's fund?
There are plenty of index tracking funds that are accessible. Okay. At those levels. It is not a rich man's game. If you look at the retail investors in Hong Kong, there are about 1 million people who have direct investments in the stock market. You should try it sometime.
I
mean, it's
I
actually,
do.
You know,
I don't not, know. I'm not
at Hong Kong U, you're probably
class.
Are you on a defined benefit pension scheme at Hong Kong U?
No, I'm sorry.
Or
I'm
a contribution.
Retired, basically.
So you already receive a defined benefit.
No, I'm not sorry. I'm on the defined contribution scheme.
Philip Cho, yes. Sitting there in the middle, silent like an umpire. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, like the tracker fund is cheap. Yes, there's no doubt. I mean, it's a fact. But the thing is, like, we need to be careful about the risk of the tracker fund. I mean, I do agree that there's other ETFs in the market. It could be diversified as possible. But I mean, in MPF, like, we're looking for a stable income. Now, I think Michael asked like a question in the middle that whether it's beat the inflation over the last 15 years, and it has, in general. And also depends on the funds that you invest. If you need a cash fund, no inflation whatsoever that you can actually achieve. But if you invest in even a typical like multi-asset balance fund, 60% in equities.
Yes, but it would have done far better if it didn't have those huge costs attached to it. I mean, there are index funds inside the MPF that cost an extra 1% per year or more because of the administrative costs of the MPF scheme.
Yeah, so now this is the administration cost issue. It's not about the fund manager issue.
Part of, no, it's the same companies that own the administrators and the,
no,
trust, the
no,
trustees,
no, no,
the
David,
custodians.
No, no, no.
If you go to HSBC, it owns all three entities. The trustee,
yes.
The custodian, and the fund manager are all owned by HSBC.
But there are other providers that in the market that they're not owned by one single company.
There are some that are split, that have split trustee arrangements.
Exactly.
But
so
nevertheless,
I think it's administration issue that the MPF need to sort out.
The point is, this is a compulsory scheme. You only get to collect it if you survive to 65, assuming that it's not withdrawn to offset your other arrangements first. If you're terminated, for example, then you get LSP, long service payment still, and that should be. I'll come onto that if you want, because it should be abolished. If you don't survive to 65,
what about
scrimped and saved all your life, okay. and then the lump sum goes to somebody else.
But what about instead of scrapping it, strengthening it? If you have these core funds, then you have three quarters of a percent fee.
If we're going to keep it, there are a number of things that we could do.
And you increase the contribution, so you make it significant, you make it 10%
more intrusive into people's lives, take more of their money away from them now, say that they can't be trusted to save it themselves, we must make them save it. This is what this is all about. Okay, so
well, this is
what people
around the world do.
But if
you know, this is what people, because it's your money as well. I mean, more than those other systems, this is your money. This
because
is the
it's
money
David. It's also
that
a way
set aside, and it's coming back to you.
Yeah, it's also a way
it's
to make
coming
sure
back
that
to you after,
the government
after
doesn't
a large
support
been,
you.
It's only coming back to you after a large amount has been creamed off, and only if you survive to 65.
Yeah,
to
but what if it,
it
was cut to 3/4%?
There is a proposal which is just piling intervention upon intervention. Is a proposal to require all MPF managers, providers, to offer this so-called core fund, which cannot charge more than 0.75% total per year, and in future will be required to reduce that figure. They're already talking about that number coming down. Now that's clearly more intervention, because some managers will say, well, we just can't do that and still make a profit. We're going to have to close and merge with others.
Other managers,
you're reducing competition, which generally doesn't improve the pricing. And the second thing is that other managers, if they're forced to do such a thing, then they will put their worst investments into the lowball fund and try to get better performing funds that still charge more money. So that there's going to have those conflicts of interest. They'll try to sell the funds which charge more than the 0.75%.
But you know, isn't there a bit of logic? You know, David Webb, you were saying that let people do it voluntarily, let them save money, don't force them to
That's
save
what
money.
We did until 2000.
I know, but you know,
it worked pretty well, didn't it?
I know, but the other side of the coin now, if you look at it, is this: if you don't make people like Hugh was pointing out, everywhere in the world they do that. If you don't make people save a certain amount of money, and if not everybody is responsible enough to do it, some of them don't. And then if they don't save it, when they retire, they have no income, then they have to rely on government handouts. So isn't there a bit of logic to say, save a certain amount of money like every other government does in the world?
There will always be some people who fall back onto a social safety net, which we should have through misfortune or whatever reasons. They have a divorce, they have a business failure, a bankruptcy or whatever. And by the time they get to 65 and collect their MPF money, they use it to pay off their debts. There will always be people in that category. That's not a reason to force savings upon everybody in the whole community.
This isn't terribly controversial, David Webb. I mean, this is the World Bank advice. The World Bank advice.
World Bank is wrong.
David Webb is right.
There's a bunch of bureaucrats on defined benefit pensions. They don't have to worry about all this. And in fact, most of the bureaucrats in our government who designed this thing, they are on defined benefit pensions. In other words, they get a percentage of their salary forever after they retire, regardless. It's not based on what they put into it. It's only since 2000 that the government employment contracts have been based on defined contribution schemes. So all of the senior bureaucrats today who are promoting this, and many of the people in academia as well, are on defined benefit schemes that they won't have to worry about the MPF.
What the World Bank says is you don't rely on one thing. You don't just cross your fingers and hope that everybody will be good and save.
We're not relying on one thing.
Like
we have CSSA, we have voluntary savings, and now after 2000 we have this compulsory scheme.
Yeah, because that's what the World Bank suggests, that you have a mandatory privately managed fully funded contribution scheme as one of those pillars.
Well, I think they're wrong.
You don't put all your eggs in one.
Do you know how much the Hong Kong public have spent over the last 15 years on this scheme?
Oh, $600 billion, is it, or something?
No, how much have they spent on managing the scheme, administering it, and so on? Because the MPF put out...
Who has the number?
I do. I'll tell you. The MPF yesterday put out a defensive press release saying, now the scheme has $600 billion in it. They didn't mention also that there is also schemes, occupational retirement schemes, ordinance schemes, which are very equivalent to that, with another $300 billion. That's a total of $900 billion in the two schemes now. And they mentioned on the $600 billion that of that, $120 is accumulated returns. The other $480 is just the contribution amounts. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's $120 of gains in there. But over that period, they've spent something like $80 billion just managing it. Okay, so there's $120 for the employees when they retire, at $80 billion of expenses. I mean, that's a horrible ratio. And if you take the ORSO scheme as well, it's over $100 billion has been spent on these schemes because of the mandatory nature of the MPF.
But no, I don't think anyone's arguing that the fees are too high.
A lot of money.
Can I put that to Philip Cho? Mm. Yeah, $80 billion.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it seems it's all about the fees.
The current annual rate is about...
Yeah, let Philip
Cho,
let him answer, Philip Cho.
I'm just telling you, it's 1.6% times $900 billion, okay?
Yes, it is a fee issue. It is a fee issue. We agree that in 2005, we start talking about the fees was too high, and then everybody talk about that. And the thing is, we look at the fees, the manager's fees are reasonably charged on an active basis, and it's all about the admin fees that we think that there will be lots of room for improvement. I mean, look, the admin fees right now, they charge as a percentage of asset. And David has $1 million in the MPF account. I have $1 in the MPF account. We charge on the same percentage. Now, can the providers or the industry think about, can they be charged on a per-member basis? And the balance grow, the percentage will be much smaller.
That's not how you charge for other forms of collective investment, such as unit trusts and real estate investment trusts. You do charge proportionate to the amount.
Yeah, on the investment
in the
side,
system.
Yes.
But here's a question. If you want compulsory savings, why do we force people to use fund managers? Why not have a scheme in which you can choose your own investments, but you're not allowed to withdraw it? No, it's not. I'm saying let's introduce, if you're going to keep this scheme, let's introduce the option for those who wish to of opening an account with a stockbroker and buying shares in the market, including things like the tracker fund or bank shares or whatever it is that they want to buy, with proper prudential limits, not more than 10% in one stock, for example, and not buying warrants, perhaps, but allow people to manage their own MPF scheme.
But they can choose their own. There's a range of schemes.
They all, every single investment available in the MPF is a managed fund, right?
Yes.
Okay, so there's no controversy about the fact that in every case you have to pay a fund manager to look after your money. Why not be allowed to simply pay a flat, maybe $500 annual fee for the overhead of the arrangement, and then choose your own stocks, time deposits, maybe even gold.
Right, David Webb. Yeah, Philip Chair.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, we need to be careful that, like, there are 2.5 million people in the market, and a big chunk of that, which Professor said, that they are low income, they don't have any knowledge about.
I'm saying allow. I'm not trying to add more compulsion to this. I'm saying give people the choice. It would be a bit more popular if those who do understand how to look after their own money, for example, because they're working for an MPF manager. That they were allowed to pick their own stocks and not have the incredible overheads that are charged to them under the current arrangements.
Yeah, but Philip Cho, you were saying.
Yeah, but you don't just buy stocks for like based on stocks like for your own retirement investment, right? I mean, stocks are so volatile. And look at the last quarter. No, like look at last quarter.
Look at what's in these funds. Yeah. Okay, inside these funds is stocks. Philip.
Yeah, but
that's
diversified.
That. That's
it's diversified. One fund has like 80 stocks there. Like, so you don't have the concentration risk.
As I said, you would put some limit on the percentage of that you could have in any one stock, but you could still have forced savings, but free choice over what kind of savings you make within that.
Okay.
And that would
all
be
right, well,
we've got
a break for the news at 9 o'clock. We can continue. We've got quite a few emails as well with interesting ideas to get to after that. The weather briefly before the news. Sunny periods with some haze. Maximum temperature about 26 degrees. The outlook turning cooler in the next few days. 23 degrees now. Humidity 83%.
You're listening to the news on RTHK.
Welcome back. This is Backchat on a Wednesday morning with Michael Ciccone and me, Hugh Chiverton. We're talking about the MPF as it celebrates. Yesterday, I think, was the actual day, a 15th anniversary, looking at the highs and lows and the future of the Mandatory Provident Fund. We have with us in our central studio Lau Chi Kwong, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Social Work and Social Administration at Hong Kong U, Chairman of the Community Care Fund Task Force under the Commission on Poverty, Philip Cho, who's Director of Investment Services at Towers Watson, and David Webb, a shareholder activist, founder of website.com. We're also joined now by Chan Kee-Biew, who's convener of the Hong Kong Business Community Joint Conference, honorary chairman of the Hong Kong Electronic Industries Association. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about that deal on the Express Rail Link funding and also hearing more from Operation Santa Claus. Once again, our email address is backchat@rthk.hk. We'd like to hear from you. You can go to our Facebook page, which is Backchat on RTHK Radio 3, and comment there, or you can call us on 233-88266, and we've got a call, I think, coming up a little bit later. First of all, some comment from the emails. Rick's made a kind of running commentary on what people have been saying, but Rick's main point is dispense with fund managers who do not perform and have a default option of ETFs, the Hong Kong Tracker, for example. That's a kind of variation on what David Webb was talking about before the news, an unmanaged account option. Rick also says that's not going to work, David. How can they control it? I'm not sure if he's got his tongue in his cheek when he says that. Jalal says, I hate to say this, but David Webb is right. The MPF schemes were designed by the banks, for the banks, without ordinary and especially poor people in mind. Hong Kong people don't want MPF. They want universal pensions. Jeffrey says, I'm a middle class, $40,000 a month, now 50 and still can't purchase a home. MPF pay $1,000 but only save $400. Where is my other $600 gone? That comes from Jeffrey. Our email address, once again, is backchat@rthk.hk. Chan Kee-Biew, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you very much indeed for joining us. The other thing which is under discussion at the moment, which we haven't really talked about so far, is the offset mechanism.
Yes.
Explain, because a lot of people will say it's unfair at the moment. It's unfair. It gives an unfair advantage to employers. How do you see the offset mechanism, the point of the offset mechanism?
I don't think it's unfair because originally, 15 years ago, when the government tried to introduce the MPF, they did make a compromise with the industry and also with the business sector that this MPF can be used to offset certain place and also to mitigate and also the long-term service contracts payments. So only under that circumstances, 15 years ago, the commercial sectors agree for the MPF. Otherwise, there was no MPF at all. And now the government is going to scrap the offset mechanism, which is unfair to the employers. And because of this mechanism, in the past, there were very few what we call, you know, the boss, when things goes bad, they just disappear. And then there's a kind of some kind of protection for the employees. So the mechanism has been working so good and so well. And for a lot of industries in which the employer on a short-term contract, they have to settle the certain place and all that within maybe 2 to 3 years. And a lot of them have to do it every month. And now, if one cannot offset the certain pace, then this SME cannot have the money for the extra payout for the servants. So I think as representative of the commerce and also the business sector, we are strongly opposed to such a suggestion.
Lord Chi Kwong, what do you think?
Well, we have to look at the accounts. Last year, the amount of offset made was around $3 billion. And we are talking about $300 billion total payroll in Hong Kong, which only constitutes something around 0.3 to 0.4% of the total payroll. And I still don't really understand why an increase in 0.3 to 0.4% of the payroll cannot be absorbed in every year salary adjustment. And that will create an enormous burden on the budget, which I can't really understand the budget thing. If somebody telling me that because of the whole thing, that it will they become bankrupt or they can't do the business, I really
Wouldn't
hope people look at their own budgets.
Some labor costs are a more significant proportion of business costs for some industries than others.
Yes, I understand that, particularly when you're talking about low-paid jobs, the percentage can be higher. But exactly, that is what the long service payment and severance payment today, what it's performing in terms of its function is primarily a kind of unemployment benefit rather than anything related to retirement. And if you think in terms of particularly the low income groups, well, if they are contributing only something like 5%, and for those who earn below 7,100, they are not contributing at all. At the end of the day, they have no retirement protection. That's
so
the problem.
So the scheme fails. Yeah, I mean the problem is this: that the long service payment, and before that the severance payment arrangements, which were introduced in 1974. These were basically privatization of social obligations. The government wanted to push onto employers the cost of paying unemployment benefits when people were made redundant in factories during the crash of 1974. But when the MPF was introduced, what they should have done is brought the LSP to a close, basically, because the two things do conflict, and one was intended to replace the other, which is why the offset arrangement exists. And if you look at, I've got a quote here from what the government told LegCo in 1995 when they tabled the MPF bill. And they said, at present, the employer's contributions to a retirement scheme may be set off against any amount the he has paid out for severance payments or long service payments. Employers do not pay twice. Severance payments and long service payments are not designed as supplementary retirement schemes. They are intended to be alternatives to these retirement schemes. This is why the offsetting provisions exist under the present voluntary system of occupational retirement schemes, and we do not intend to change it under the MPF. So there was a clear understanding of that these were alternatives and that the MPF was basically an upgrade to the system.
Well,
and after 15 years, it's now time to actually say, look, because of these conflicts and because of the lack of portability, which is impeding the reduction of costs because of these split payment arrangements, that we need to... We do need to terminate the offset,
okay,
but we also
Mr.
need
Chan,
to terminate the accrual of the long service payments.
Okay, Mr. Chan?
No, I don't think it's fair to do that. I mean,
well, let me explain my proposal.
No, because it's
not as bad as, as you're suggesting.
Mr. Chan, why is it not fair?
Yeah, but if you look at a lot of the recent slowdown in China, a lot of, because there's not such an offset or a scheme, a lot of the owner just disappear. And then who is going to foot the bill? So in Hong Kong in the past, this has been kind of smoothed out, and then you don't have a lot of very tragic situations. So I think the mechanism is doing so well, and I don't think it's fair. You link everything together. The long service and service are a employer-employee relationship thing. As you say, it's, you know, to offset, to reduce some of the impacts when the
if we stop accruing, and then
you're talking about a retirement scheme. That's totally different thing.
I'm suggesting, Mr. Cheung, that we terminate the LSP arrangement. We don't destroy anyone's accrued entitlements to LSP, but we bring it to an end, say, at the end of this year or end of next year, and we say, after that, if you sign a new employment contract, there won't be any LSP, there will just be MPF. You will have full portability of all the contributions, and there won't be any offset because there won't be any LSP if you are made redundant during that employment period, because the purpose of MPF is for retirement, not to be paid out every few years when you change jobs.
Mr. Chan, what about the point also made by Lau Chi Kwong that long service payments are actually a very small amount? Was it 0.3% or something of the payroll? And when employers like yourself warn of a 5-7% increase in labour costs as a consequence of scrapping the offset mechanism, that's just panic talk, the kind of panic talk we've had in the past over minimum wage.
Well, I think you cannot just use percentage. Well, for a company closing down or has to collapse or whatever, it's 100%, not 0.3%. I mean, it's not fair. You understand what I mean? For my company or a company that's closing down, the severance pay, all these are 100% of the money, not 0.3% of the whole Hong Kong wage. So it's a wrong comparison.
Okay, take your point.
I mean, Hong Kong will not come to help a company in distress. Nobody can do that.
Okay, our number is 233-88266. We've got a caller, Alan, on the line now. Alan, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi,
morning.
Your point?
Morning. I agree very much with what David's saying. And obviously there's some very vested interest to maintain the MPF as it is in its current format, because I think the people who manage those funds see it as manna from heaven. And I think that's how it was introduced some 15 years ago. I believe, obviously, there was some background research done prior to the MPF being established. And it was based, to some extent, on the CPF in Singapore. Now, obviously, David's on about making improvements to MPF. And if you do a comparison between the MPF here in Hong Kong and CPF in Singapore, you will find that the CPF scheme in Singapore is far more flexible in terms of how it's used, how it can be accessed, and also in terms of very little cost being incurred to those people who make contributions. I just wondered...
It's much larger as well, of course, Alan, isn't it? So it's like 20% or something?
Well, no, it used to be 10 and 10. But prior to the economic crisis, it was reduced to 5 and 5, I believe. But,
It's around 27% contribution in CPF for the employee.
The way it works is that people can use the funds they have saved in that to buy their HDB home in Singapore, which you can't do here.
After a while.
Yes, after a while, correct, but... Is that present in the MPF?
No, the only withdrawal in MPF that's now allowed and recently introduced is terminal illness. You have to get a certification that you're going to die.
But what I'm saying is that you're about the severance payments and things like that being taken out of the MPF. It's correct. It should be a retirement vehicle.
But Ellen, are you arguing against the MPF, or you think it should be changed, fine-tuned in such a way that is not a manna from heaven for fund managers?
I would just say it was implemented, and you've got to question the logic behind how it was implemented, if it was based on a worldwide search for a vehicle where people can put money for their retirement. And it's obviously done in a certain way here, as far as I can see, is that the people who manage it benefit the most in terms of doing very little for what they get paid.
Well, gentlemen, but one thing is that our company, a lot of private companies before introduction of MPF, they also have a, what they call a provident fund. It's being organized or being administered by insurance company or some other financial institution. Now, under normally under such provident fund scheme, when the employee leaves the company, they are entitled to take out the money or their own contribution and part of the employer's contribution. And it's got nothing to do with retirement. So if you look at the definition of provident fund and you try to link it with retirement, there's two different things.
Well, I think that's how it's been packaged to most people who go about their business without much interest in the stock market or other bits and pieces. They think they're putting money into a vehicle which will safeguard themselves when they retire or have to retire or start working, yes?
But if you try to mix up everything, you know, even now the government is maybe contemplating putting the whole issue under the department for helping the poor. It's got nothing to do with helping the poor. It's an employee
Basically, you know, I mean, the scheme forces a relatively small number of people who could have saved but would not have saved without it to save. But if those people are so reckless as not to save when they can, they're the same sort of people who will take the lump sum at 65 and burn it on a cruise holiday or a night at Happy Valley. So the scheme is completely misconceived if the objective was to prevent the reckless from spending all of their incomes during their lives, because they can still do that at 65, having put the money into the MPF.
Logic Kong, is it better just to scrap the... I mean, the MPF has caused such grief to so many people, different opinions. Is it better to just scrap it and then have a general retirement, universal retirement plan?
Well, I'm not particularly negative towards universal pensions, but if you look around the world, most government in the world is trying to strengthen what we call the individual accounts, defined contributions, which is basically one of the important pillars that every country is trying to look at because of the aging population. You just can't rely on the next generation or the next generation to be able to support a very large portion of the population basically retired. Well, we're looking at something like 2.5 million people retire 30 to 40 years down the road, and you don't expect the existing population don't have to increase tax, no matter it's profit tax or salary tax, in order to finance our health and welfare budgets, purely because we have over 36% of the population 65 years old.
Michael, the first part of your proposal is right, scrap the MPF. The second part, introduce universal pensions, is wrong because it would go to people like me who don't need it. It would be spraying money around, and a small amount of it would land in the right place for people who do need it. So you need to have a means-tested welfare payment system, which is currently called CSSA, and look at improving that for people who are in need, and not just spraying the money around on a universal basis, because that's what's brought socialist governments in Europe to their knees, basically. They have schemes they can no longer afford.
Well, gentlemen, if you look at the world economy, and what happened is that what the socialist thinking 40 or 30 years ago doesn't work is, suppose a young man or woman start working at 25, retire at 65. Now, when things are good, you are supposed to have continuous employment for 40 years. But nowadays, who can guarantee you continuous employment for 40 years? This is number one.
The government can. They'll still be in business.
I don't think it's an issue about capitalists or socialists. If you look at... But if everybody look at 30 or 40 years ago when these countries are setting up these universal pensions, they are already positive towards the population growth because they are thinking increasing young population. But today, what we are looking at is a purely different world. We are looking at a shrinking labor force and increased retired population. So we have to think in terms of how to strengthen our individual account. Well, I have to say, before the setting up the MPF, I'm all for the Central Provident Fund because of the scale or size of the economy of Hong Kong. But because the British colonial government is not very trusting. A central provident fund after 1997 to be influenced by the so-called Beijing government, so to speak. So they rather put the money in the private sector, where it's primarily managed by banks and insurance companies. And you know the British interests constitute more than 50% in those markets. So that is a very political decision prior to 1997. But now we have the MPF. I don't think we can go back to anything like a central provident fund. So I think the much better bet is to improve on it, to make it more efficient, and therefore it makes money actually grows as it should be.
But logic on, you know, you do a lot of work with poverty. You're in the Poverty Commission. You think that keeping the MPF as it is now will help the people that you help in other commissions, like the Poverty Commission?
Therefore, we need to scrap the offset arrangement, and we have to improve the schemes in the sense.
Well, will you agree then to scrap the LSP as well and say, look, you can't have both. You can't make employers pay twice.
I think Davies' proposal is can be discussed. Well, but if we scrap the whole thing about the long service payment, severance payment, we have to think in terms of, should we have in place a better unemployment protection?
It's called CSSA.
Well, David, I know it better than you.
You may want to improve CSSA, but we do have a scheme that if you lose your job and you don't have income, you can apply to the government for a handout, and they will give it to you. It may not be as high as it should be, but there is that system in place, and that is appropriate, and that is why the 1974 arrangements were wrong in the first place. They introduced severance payments to try to reduce the obligation on government.
It's not designed for as a kind of employment.
It's designed to supplement anyone who doesn't have the income and assets.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. Well, a couple more comments from listeners, kind of echoing points we've made so far. James says on our Facebook page, the offset mechanism is stealing from an employee's pension pot to fulfil the employer's legal obligation to reward long service, an immoral and farcical arrangement. TC says the MPF essentially is helping financial institutions gather funds to gamble. Not only is that in general, the return is unreasonably low. Financial institutions levying fees to everyone even when performance is bad. Things like the MPF should be handled centrally by the government, for example, Macau and Canada. And Fiona says, Michael has said the MPF helped those with $15,000 or lower incomes, but I believe it does more harm than good. It gives people a false hope that they can retire without any financial worries. I started my career at $6,000 a month 20 years ago, but I learned a lot in making my investments. More importantly, investment is all about investment time. Sadly, many of those low income have missed the chance to invest and learn how to invest over the past 15 years. By the way, what has the MPFA done so far? That comes from Fiona. Thank you, Fiona. Thank you, Alan, our caller, and thank you to our guests this morning. To Chen Kebiu, who's the convener of the Hong Kong Business Community Joint Conference. To Lo Chi Kuang from the University of Hong Kong. Philip Cho, Director of Investment Services at Towers Watson. And David Webb, shareholder activist and founder of website.com. Thank you all very much indeed. 24 minutes past 9.